Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to introduce everyone to Paige Findirty, those of you that need an introduction. Paige is founding partner of Behind Genius Ventures, an early stage fund investing at pre-seed and seed and product-led companies focused on the future of work and play. She is author of Seed to Harvest, a book she wrote to demystify the business of venture capital, and she holds a degree in computer science from San Diego State University. Thank you so much for joining me, Paige. It's great to have you here with me today.
Of course. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, we'll see about that. So jumping straight into things, you graduated from SESU in 2020, which for those of us that have forgotten was last year, and launched Behind Genius in early 2021. How did you draw that line from, you know, coming out of university as a CS grad to launching a fund? Because that seems super ambitious to kind of straight out of uni, right, I'm gonna go into venture and I'm going to raise my own fund.
Yeah, it's absolutely quite a transition coming from a college student pre-pandemic to a fund manager, hopefully post-pandemic. So the way that I got into venture, I actually got really interested in it my junior year of college, and I wrote down when I was 19 that I would start a venture firm in the next 10 years. I didn't know at that point in time how much that time would be accordion together. So I would say there are a couple major contributing factors to me starting a venture fund. The first was I had worked at a growth equity firm. I had done a venture capital competition, and my family's in San Diego. And so I was looking for an opportunity to work in early stage venture in San Diego. And I was looking, digging, like couldn't really find one. So I was like, okay, cool. Like, I guess I can like move somewhere else and, you know, maybe be there for a couple of years and try and come back to San Diego later. So I went through interviewing process with a great firm in Boston. I was going to be their youngest like partner track associate, and they had made all sorts of arrangements around like what I was like asking for. But it came to like the day where I had to make a decision. I just remember asking for a sign, and that was the day that Kobe Bryant died. And all over social media was like this outpouring of like, don't let anyone else dictate your agenda. Like Kobe really lived with family values, and that was really core to who he was, both as an athlete and as a person. And I just remember being like, oh, like this is how I want people to view me. Like I want them to know that my family values are really close to my heart, and I want to make decisions based on that and not let other people's opinions of what I should or shouldn't be doing dictate like my life. And so I ended up turning that position down, had no other job offers. So I was just like, all right, like what's next? And I had this enduring passion for venture. I think it encompassed so many of the things I was excited about, like talking to early stage entrepreneurs and helping them with strategy and building a business of my own. And so I just started like talking to, I must have had like at least 300 conversations with other VCs over the summer. I was working at a startup, and nights and weekends I was like digging into like TechCrunch articles and newsletters and reading all sorts of history on venture. It was just like an unmistakable calling for me. And so I started writing about that. I think I found this journal when I was home yesterday, and it was from 2014. And it was like, I've lost the spark of writing. Like maybe one day it will come back again. So dramatic. But I've kept journals like throughout my whole life. I've always really enjoyed writing. And what's funny is that's what ended up leading me to venture. So I started writing online, demystifying concepts that turned into a book called Seed to Harvest. And in the process of Seed to Harvest, I ended up leading my first syndicate. And I ended up leading it like all remotely. I collected 17 investors. They invested 50K in a company called Palette in their pre-seed round. Palette is a community-oriented job board platform and powers creators like Lenny and Packy McCormick, really great newsletter writers. And I was like, that was one of the harder things that I've ever done. I remember asking for allocation, just hanging up the phone and being like, oh boy, like, I don't know how to do this. I haven't done this before. And funny enough, I got introduced to my partner, Josh, around the same time. So he really helped me through the logistics of running my first syndicate And as we started to have more like bi-weekly deal flow calls and just text back and forth about venture, it became very clear to both of us that we'd make great business partners. I think we have a lot of alignment in terms of our value structure, our demographics. I'm 23, he's 24. And then we had very complementary backgrounds. And a similar approach to, we both wanted to build a firm. That was very important to us. Like, I don't want to build a fund. I want to build a firm that's like a recognizable, like in the ecosystem, and hopefully like hire on other investors and train them so they can go on to launch their own funds. And
so value beyond the capital, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's like a lot of tossing around a value add, but I think that one of the biggest value adds is not offering unsolicited advice. And I think we are uniquely positioned to do that given the fact that we are quite young and early in our careers. So yeah, that's kind of how it started. It was less of a decision for me to join an established firm versus start my own. Rather, it was me looking at my constraints of, I want to stay in San Diego and I love venture, so I'm going to explore that. Kind of culminated in me starting a venture firm after having built a community on Twitter, writing a book. So yeah, it's been quite a, I call it like my rookie year. I wrote my first check December 2nd. So it's been a year of me being an active check writer.
So you wrote your first, so out of the fund or personally, like in the syndicate?
Out of the syndicate. Yeah. Definitely didn't have a lot of extra money on hand graduating from college. I luckily got out.
Unsurprisingly.
Yeah. I luckily got out debt free. I had like a scholarship and I worked all through school, and I felt really lucky to be in that position because I didn't have like student debt to pay down, but I definitely didn't have any extra money laying around to write like a, honestly, even like a 5K check into a startup. But I was finding like these incredible founders and I wanted to be involved. So that's how I got started.
Well, that's kind of what it's all about. You mentioned earlier, I'm like, that. Like, I think that's probably the most inspirational story that I've heard. I think 14-year-old you will probably, you know, be looking forward in time and saying, well, yeah, you made it. This is awesome. And not only have you written, you've also written a book. But you mentioned constraints. Like, as an emerging manager, I'm guessing you, well, not just an emerging manager, emerging manager who's like 23 years old, university graduate, hasn't had like, you know, hasn't had a ton of experience working in a startup or working with a venture fund. Like, there must have been a bunch of challenges you faced. What would you do differently if you had to do it all again?
That's a really great question. So I was writing about this yesterday. So in physics, there's this concept of potential to kinetic energy. And there's a calculation that, you know, puts those together. And I'd never really understood how important this equation was until I went through the fundraising process myself. So the more potential energy that you store, the more kinetic energy you can access immediately. And I don't think that we had like a ton of potential energy going into our first fundraise. I see creators like Packy McCormick, for example. I think that he gathered like a ton of potential energy and then was like, cool, starting a venture fund and raised it. And I think that that's a really smart idea, is to save up a lot of potential energy going into your raise and then start to activate those relationships. We had like teeny tiny bit of that. I had a community on Twitter of maybe like 10,000 followers. I had a couple of folks who, 30 people who had invested in my syndicates. And I was like, it's go time. Like, we're ready. And I don't think we had a deck together until like a month into fundraising. So I think I would have stored up next time more potential energy before turning the fundraising lever on. I think this is important both for fund managers and founders. And then I think that like continuing to show up with great energy is really key. As going through this process and realizing how much of it is just not giving up is pretty nuts. Like, you'll have days where you're just laying on the floor and you're like, everything I'm doing is bad, and like, I'm not even going to be that good at this, and like, blah, blah, blah. And then you kind of have to go back and be like, okay, all right, let's take a deep breath. Like, have we slept? Have we exercised? Have we drank water? Like, let's go through those motions, and then let's go back and like, you know, go back to your task list and, you know, check a couple things off. I think that listening to this podcast called Startup around the story of Gimlet Media getting founded has been really great. It was recommended to me by my friend Adam Faze, who's also a podcast producer. And I was like listening to that and knowing that they sold for $230 million to Spotify. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, everyone's kind of holding it together with duct tape and prayer. So I think knowing that you're not alone in that. And then I think like getting more relentless about protecting my energy. I think when I got started, I would say yes to a lot of things, a lot of like meetings and things like that. And now thinking more critically about it, it's kind of like when I add something else onto my plate, these are kind of like the three questions that I go through. Like, one, does it align with my values to educate the next generation of venture investors, to provide good returns to my LPs, and to be a great partner to the founders that we work with? You know, additionally to that, like spending time with my family. The second is, does it have a lot of impact? So I think that was a really hard thing for me to think about. But if there's something where I could be spending my time, this leads into the next question. The next question is, what am I moving off my plate to do this right now? So for example, if doing like a speaking engagement to 50 people versus maybe spending an hour writing something that could reach like, you know, 5,000 people, like what is the scope of that impact? There are, I would say, relativities in terms of the depth of that impact, but I think I've been thinking about that more. And then building out a task management list was really important for me to understand, okay, what am I like shifting off my plate to do something? And just being very clear about my boundaries with other people. I think I used to like hold off and just like not reply to some things where I was having like a gut feeling about that. But now I can be like, nope, sorry, like I'm not available this day, or like I am prioritizing, you know, X, Y, and Z, and unfortunately I can't do this, but happy to like schedule further out in advance. So I think those are some of the things that I've been learning. It's definitely been a bit of trial by fire, especially doing it as like a build in public thing.
That's kind of crazy because these are lessons that I only learned in the last couple of years, and I'm sort of in my 40s now, right? But I think a couple of things that I would definitely kind of that resonate and I would definitely echo. So, and just as a quick aside, for those of our listeners that don't know, Paki McCormack has a newsletter called Not Boring, and it is really, really worth subscribing to if you have the time to read it, and you should find the time to read it, which clearly I don't have the time to do anything, but it is really, really worth it. So the couple of things that you talked about, right? That potential to kinetic energy. It's interesting. I'm a runner and I'm looking at this at the moment as well. I'm reading a book that is really all around this sort of issue of potential to kinetic energy within your kind of facial system. But I think it's really important. As a founder, I raised my pre-seed, like the people that I raised my pre-seed from, I'd been talking to for 5 years without any
transactional.
Yeah, nothing transactional. Yeah. There was no expectation. I didn't enter into those conversations thinking down the track, I'm going to need these guys to raise some money off of either, like at all. But it's about building, to your point, that potential. It's like the spring that allows you to lift yourself that much higher. I think that's super important because I think people who come into it cold and just sort of, hey, I'm just going to start this thing, they will get fatigued very quickly because basically they'll run out of that energy really quickly, right?
Yeah, I was going to say we definitely did that. So I think that's one of the things that I'll change for the next fund in terms of just like storing up a lot more potential energy. I think, yeah, it all goes back to like elementary physics. So I actually started in like mechanical engineering, which I think is a very useful background. I definitely look at the world from a systems engineering point of view.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think you and I also have talked about in the past, like you did your dissertation on spatial audio and this sort of stuff. Like there's some super interesting, I think, super interesting learnings that absolutely translate from kind of that physics background into the kind of IRL world, right? But the second thing that I think was really, again, really critical and kind of blessed to have you here as well is being really protective about your time. And it's one of the things I found myself becoming more and more protective about the further along I go, to the extent that I've personally disengaged with a couple of the clients that I currently have so that I can focus on building, because I was getting kind of completely distracted by what's going on in their businesses rather than in my own businesses, right? So I think that's a super important lesson. Like, people need to figure out how to say no better and quicker, and not everyone's great at that. I wanted to also ask, you mentioned your partner, so your other founding partner at Behind Genius, so Joshua Schisserman. So you talked a little bit about how you met, like via the syndicate and so on, but what was the real chemistry that catalyzed Behind Genius? Like, why was it Josh? And Josh, for example, I know works with startups as well. So I know there's a massive kind of balancing act that's going on between you all. And having spoken to both of you, like your intertwined story is super incredible. I'd love to just understand a little bit more about how that all happened.
Absolutely. So one thing that's changed about my perspective as an investor becoming a fund manager is the importance of timing. And I think the importance of timing had a lot to do with the initial chemistry that catalyzed behind Genius Ventures. When Josh and I met, we were both, so he was like writing angel checks and running a recruiting firm. And I was at WorkOS as a developer success engineer and had just started my first syndicate. And he had just finished his first one. And so he had come out of it with like a lot of really great learnings that some people give very generic advice. And then some people give advice that you can tell has been very hard won. And Josh definitely gave the latter. And I think I honestly came off our initial call with a feeling that I was like with my boyfriend at the time. And I was like, yeah, this is the person that I'm going to work with in some fashion in the future. And it was so funny going back to Josh and having this conversation a couple months ago, is he had said the same to his girlfriend. And I think it was just so funny. I would say we're both very intuitive people, and that's important to us as investors and people, is leaning into that intuition. And then I think as with investing, you kind of like back that up with numbers. So as we've gotten to know each other and done deals together and fundraised, I think that that's been an incredible journey to get to know like who he is as a businessman and a person. Like when hard things come up, or, you know, he got like $1 million no's in the process. And I think that staying true to that partnership has been really important in like this first step of the journey, and will continue to be important. So that's kind of like what the chemistry was initially. And I think that like continuing to nurture that relationship really looks like digging into all of the nuances of venture. Sometimes I am really frustrated by how much administrative work there goes into being a fund manager. I was talking about this with one of our LPs, Mark Mullen at Bonfire, who has done like multiple funds across different firms and is very well educated on like how much administrative lift things can be. But he was like, you know, like no one else is going to get that deep understanding of, you know, why documents are the way they are, like digging deep into the legal nuances. And I think that looking at some of the things that we thought were obstacles, but were really entrenched learnings, I think both of us being really motivated by learning more about the venture space has been very powerful in terms of that continuous motivation. I think that I don't remember exactly what the saying was. It's like venture will make you like wealthy in the long term, but not rich in the short term. It's a very like illiquid field. And I think that keeping your eye on the long term in terms of motivation can be really helpful, because day to day, it's like a lot of ups and downs.
It's your pension, not your income.
Yeah, like,
Exactly. That's maybe the best way to think about it, right? So thinking about the fund itself, right? Like, or not the fund, but like the fund thesis. So, I mean, we're in some exciting times. You know, Facebook's just rebranded. Where do you actually see the future of work and play? Like, what are the trends that you're most excited about right now? And I have a kind of additional question to that. Like, what does a venture have to have for you to consider investing beyond the stage and sector, right? So, you know, A, what is it that you love right now? Like, what is work and play, and where are your dollars going? And what does there need to be beyond that for you guys to invest?
Absolutely. So in terms of what I love now, I think there's been this interesting delineation where you're seeing a lot of folks shift into Web3, which has been super interesting. And I think being wrapped up in a lot of the administrative aspects of running a venture fund has been a bit constraining in terms of the time that we've been able to spend understanding a new space. So that's one of the things I'm really excited to dig into in our next chapter. But one of the areas that I've been really excited about is specifically that future of play aspect of our thesis. So, you know, technology has been around for a long time, and a lot of the innovations have gone towards work. And like, how can we make people work more efficiently? And how can we like illuminate new job paths through that economic development and innovation? The future of play is really interesting because we've taken all this technology and applied it to how we work, but we don't work all the time. there's probably some people listening to this podcast that work all the time, so this is not directed towards them. But I think that play is like a really important aspect of developing that like systems level thinking. Like it's working in a different way in terms of connecting the dots and giving your head enough space to kind of like go out on its own exploration. So we invest in a company called Averon that's, I think, a really great crystallization of some of the trends that we're seeing. So the gamification of play and fitness, they're kind of like Peloton for rowing. And Andy's Wedge is really in the investments that they've made in terms of making these rowing games that are super interactive and creating the infrastructure for other fitness equipment to build on. So I think that's a really great example of a company at the future of play that we're really excited about. On the future of work side, I would say it's delineated into Web 2 and Web 3 technologies. I still think there's an incredible amount of innovation that can happen in other industries. Like a lot of platforms right now serve a lot of knowledge workers, but I still think there's a ton of opportunities in terms of digital innovation in the blue collar workforce. There's a company in San Diego whose founder I'm close with called CourseKey, and they make basically learning management software for trade schools. And it's a very underserved market. You know, most people are creating software for colleges, but they're not really focusing on trade schools. And it's really important that we have like electricians and plumbers. I am a deep believer in the understanding that physical things carry spiritual weight. And we live in a physical world. We're not in the metaverse yet. And there's a lot of really important things that have to happen in the physical space in terms of like maintenance and like building and construction that I think is still relatively like pen and paper. So there's a lot of interesting innovations going on there. And then the creator ecosystem is the space I'm really excited about as a creator myself. So we've made a bunch of investments there. I think a couple of my favorite ones recently were FIPM. It's kind of like a glass board for creators so they can see how much other creators are paid by brands, what the experience was like working with those brands. And I think it creates a lot of transparency that we haven't really seen for influencers before. It's usually like, it's kind of why you saw the rise of hype houses. Like if people wanted to be successful, they really had to be around the people that knew these business models, because it wasn't getting written about there wasn't like a how to be an influencer 101 class in college. You kind of have to go and learn from the source. And so I think that they're doing an incredible service democratizing that access to information to creators who might not have that reach yet, but want to conduct business with like larger brands.
Just thinking about what you were saying there, right? So the future of work, and 100% agree, like most tech at the moment is solving HR problems, or yes, it's getting kind of transactional work, but at the office level, automated as opposed to anything else. And it's interesting in China, as an example, like when you go through your middle school kind of exams, your matriculation, by law, only 50% can progress to the next stage. The balance 50% have to go into trades. Now, it's China, they mandate, right? I think in the West, we don't mandate. And obviously, everyone has the aspiration to go to university, or, well, a lot of people have that aspiration, or that aspiration is kind of elevated above everything else. And I think there is absolutely space for making those trades, which are skills, like they are skills, let's be really, really, really clear about that. And not just skills, but like absolutely essential skills, you know, as we found out over the course of the last year. Like you cannot get away with not having drivers, not having plumbers, not having electricians. Like, you know, you cannot get away with people not being in supermarkets. You can't get away with nurses not being around, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is a huge amount of opportunity there. It's interesting to hear you kind of talk about it in that way.
Yeah. I have an interesting anecdote before we hop to the next thing.
Yeah, go for it.
I was at the Forbes Under 30 conference and I met this founder from Nigeria, and he had founded the first elevator maintenance school. And he was, I think he had employed like 80 employees, because all like Nigeria is getting built up a lot now and there's a ton of elevators, but there's no elevator maintenance people. So it's a huge problem. Like people are getting stuck in these massive buildings and elevators and there's no one to help them. And so I think I was like, wow, I didn't know there was like a multi-million-dollar business in like elevator maintenance and trade school for that. But there are definitely opportunities based on like how rapidly things are expanding.
There's a whole conversation you and I or others could have about the opportunity in emerging markets like Africa. I mean, the way I talk about it is in places like Kenya, you didn't have, you know, they didn't go from physical banking to web to something like they went straight to mobile with, you know, with M-Pesa. Like there are problems being solved in Africa that you and I don't even think about because they're not problems, right? Or they're just annoyances rather than actual problems. So yeah, for sure, there's a huge amount of opportunity that we don't even think about. And so when you look at an investment, it ticks the boxes of, you know, is it the future of work or play? What else has to be there? Like, what are you looking for? Team, traction? What are the most important things, especially at pre-seed, seed, where things are, metrics are harder to define and harder to kind of present? So what do you guys look for?
Absolutely. I think to preface it with the context of today's fundraising markets, it's super competitive. And we saw this like on the other side, fundraising for a venture firm, it's super competitive. And I think like companies at the pre-seed and seed stages are ultimately getting held to higher and higher bars. And that's why I think that switch from potential to kinetic energy is super important about when you turn on that fundraising lever. I would say that to be fundraising from a position of strength, it's really exciting to us to be investing in opportunities for growth and not necessarily like, hey, we're, you know, we need money to do this thing. It's like, hey, here's like an incredible opportunity. We're like bursting at the seams. You know, we need this money to hire another like 4 engineers so we can really kick this into overdrive. So I think that coming from that position of growth is really important. One of the other things is that we think about is this entrepreneur flirting with this idea or are they like married to it? Because, you know, we want to invest in founders that have billion-dollar exit events. That's how the math of venture firms work. And so I think that there's different types of financing for different people, but ultimately we're looking for someone who is married to the idea that they're working on, wants to work on it for 10 plus years, then have a like billion-dollar exit. That's super important to us. And that's not going to be every entrepreneur. And I think that it's really important as a founder to reflect and think about the type of business that you want to build. It's totally, totally great. If you want to build like not a venture backable business, it just probably won't be a fit for us. And then I think a founder who's a really great storyteller, at some point in the journey, you're always going to be selling. You're either going to be selling equity, you're going to be selling opportunity, you're going to be like, you're either selling to investors or employees. The most important one is like selling to yourself. You have to like keep yourself motivated during the whole journey that you can like get through those dark periods and have a really great support network around you that helps you get through that. So I think a lot about that storytelling and grit ability. So oftentimes a lot of the founders that we work with are maybe first time founders. And so I look to try and find examples in their past where they've demonstrated those characteristics. Yeah, grit, very important. And then I think like large market opportunities is really important. If you have a large market, you have a lot of room for error. So I think large markets that aren't super saturated yet have been really interesting to look at. So yeah.
So I think storytelling and grit are two that I love. And I think partly, and that I think most investors and founders would agree are absolutely critical when you're building a venture. I think what's also really interesting to me is, you know, that storytelling ability is one that is not something that we teach in schools particularly well. And that sort of sales ability is not something that we teach particularly well. And therefore, especially young founders who maybe haven't kind of been around the houses a bit are kind of learning that as they go. And I think getting to understand that skill set and really being able to kind of share your vision for both the business, but equally kind of, you know, the product today is not the product tomorrow, right? You want to be able to sell where the venture is going. Because to your point, it is a 10-year journey. It is a 15-year journey. It is a billion-dollar exit when you're taking venture as opposed to, you know, a great business that is throwing off cash that supports your lifestyle. Like that's equally a great thing, but it's a very different thing. And it's not where venture dollars end up going to. I wanted to move on. You're a creator, right? So I wanted to move on to your creative kind of stuff. And there's a lot of it there, right? The first question I kind of have is, you wrote a children's book on venture. Who is that really aimed at, right? So Seed to Harvest.
Yeah, great question. Seed to Harvest is an illustrated children's book about venture, but I originally wrote it because my parents told me I couldn't talk about venture at the dinner table anymore because it was so filled with jargon. And I was like, you know what? I bet other people feel this way. So I was like, let me just draw out a diagram. So I did this like page diagram of, you know, how like venture investors raise funds. They are managing other people's money, which affects the way that they look at investments. I would say it has definitely become more true for myself. I wrote this before I had written a check. And I think that going through that process of becoming a venture investor myself has definitely added nuance to what I wrote about in Seed to Harvest. But now I see it as a much larger movement in terms of getting more people involved in venture. You see all these statistics about how venture dollars are very skewed towards certain demographics. But I think like at the core of that, there's a lack of education. Just like sales isn't taught in school, like venture is not taught in school. It's a nascent industry, but it's been taught at like a couple schools, and you see like the concentration of people who come out of Stanford and Harvard and are able to raise venture money is because you get more comfortable and informal with your language around talking about it if you're always around it. So this is like one of my goals, is to get people more comfortable with like informally throwing out like words and not feeling like they're like a facade or like a sham. Like it's just like, this is the language of venture. And so I'm teaching this like venture capital investment competition team at SDSU, which is awesome. It's like a bunch of undergrad and grad students from engineering, marketing, finance, even have like someone who studied like biomedical engineering. And to see them go from at the beginning asking questions like, what is dilution, to now being able to go through a due diligence session with an entrepreneur and be able to ask thoughtful questions from a venture investor perspective. You know, I like read Seed to Harvest to all of them. And they're like, oh, like this, it was a couple classes in. And they're like, oh, like you kind of have to have the overarching vision of what venture is, how it's incentivized, and then how it works, and then why it's important. And so that was, I would say Seed to Harvest has become a much bigger movement than I originally anticipated it would be. But I wanted it. I would say it's definitely geared at like adults. I think even people that don't run their own venture firms can learn things. You know, if you're an associate or an analyst, you might not think about things like capital calls, but they're super important to how you make decisions as a venture capitalist. Cash flow management, as in other businesses, is definitely a big part of your decisions. And so I think that there is something to take both for children, who I wrote the book for originally, because I think if you can't explain something to a child, then you don't have a good enough understanding to explain it to an adult. And then also like adults who are either tangential, excited about venture, or in the space themselves. There's a ton of startup employees who don't understand venture-backed businesses, but work at them. And, you know, because of that, might not exercise their options at a startup and could cost them financially in the long term. I think that like if more people understood venture-backed companies, a lot of people would hop from like Series C company to Series C company. Because I think as an employee, that's might be one of the most straightforward paths to building generational wealth, is working at established startups with a bit lower risk and a shorter liquidity time period. But yeah, I think the vast majority of startup employees don't understand venture. So I want to make sure that more people have the tools and resources to understand the forces that are governing a lot of the decisions that their leaders make.
So the one thing I took from that entire conversation was that I need to buy this book for my mom. Because I mean, you're 100% right, right? So my mother absolutely has no clue what I do, why I do it, how I do it, like what a startup is, why I work with a startup. She'll be listening to this, by the way, every now and again. I'll get a WhatsApp message saying, you know, thumbs up to this podcast with XYZ. I was like, okay, great. And I think this, to be honest, I'm like doing this podcast, I think has helped her gain a better understanding of what I do and what venture is and why startups are important today and to me as an example. And I could not agree with you more that, and I see it on Twitter a lot, there is this trope whereby you see people saying, I would drop everything tomorrow to go and work for a venture back, you know, for a startup. Like I would drop out of university tomorrow and go work for a startup. And I kind of sit there and I said, that's not really true. Like What you're actually saying is I would go and work for a well-funded, later stage business that has the trappings of a startup, but not much of the risk, right? And it's because they don't really understand necessarily that whole kind of risk profile. And to your point, like a lot of employees I know just don't even really understand what options are. And okay, for a lot of people, there are, you know, the financial consideration is that I need cash today, not cash tomorrow. But if you're looking for cash today, there are way, way easier places to work than startups, given everything that you have to do within them. So I completely buy into your premise that that democratization of knowledge and access and understanding and language, and I'm a linguist by background, the more you can simplify something, you know, complex, the better chance you have of both understanding it yourself as well as, to your point, explaining it to others. So I think that's a really great reason to have written it. And kind of on that note of, you know, the movement, so you've built like I think a 20k plus Twitter community. How did you do that, and if you even had a purpose, and or rather how did you do it and why did you do it if you had a purpose, I guess is a question.
That's a great question. So one thing that I do want to clarify is I still think like later stage startups are so risky. Like my dad, after 30 years is working as an engineer at like smaller manufacturing companies and then like larger ones like HP. He, after his first month of working at a startup, was like, I've never learned so much in such a condensed period of my life. And I think that it can be true, you know, based on what your calibration is. If you have worked at large companies or like small businesses, then even like a Series D or something startup can be like definitely a huge intellectual challenge. I think every company brings with it those, but I'm really excited for that. On to your question, I think that a lot of people who look at Twitter from the outside think that there's a strategy, but really it was just me like vibing online and learning in public. I think that I'm excited to do more of it. I was looking at my Twitter. I was like, dang, I haven't tweeted in like 6 days. This is for like a really long streak, but you do get kind of sucked into doing a lot of work. And I now understand why a lot of people don't write about what they do, because there's a lot outside of it. But I've been writing more recently and carving out time for Greenhouse Days, which is one of my mentors is Judy Estrange, the former CTO of Cisco and was one of the inventors of the intranet. And she taught me a lot about carving out time to be creative is really important for your energy store as an individual and continuing to work on what you're working on and being excited about it. So I've been trying to do that more. But I think when I was working at a startup, we'd just spend all day doing other work, but thinking about venture. And then after the day was done, I would be like, oh, perfect, cool. I have like some time to write about this. And I think that is just like, when I was growing up, I didn't know I wanted to be a venture capitalist, but as far back as like me being six, I was like, I want to be a writer and I loved writing. And so I think for me, it was just something that came very naturally. And Twitter gave me the opportunity to find a medium where I really excelled. Like I really enjoy writing more synthesized pieces. And I think it's honestly way more challenging to write small things that have a lot of meaning than it is to write, you know, 50,000 word essays.
It's like the Hemingway kind of principles, right? Like, again, if you can't communicate it concisely and simply, and I struggle with this for sure, then should you be writing it at all? Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I think like the most important part of writing is like the 50 edits that come after you start editing. It's like, saw a tweet yesterday and it was like, I have to write 10,000 words to write 100. You know, you really have to cut down to get to the core of what you're saying. I think reading a lot of books about writing strategy. And then also my junior year in high school, I took a AP English language class and our teacher had us write a page long essay every single day for a year. So after that, I was like, cool. I was like in it. I was like, this is a lot. But outside of it, I was like, okay, cool. I feel like I have a good understanding of like how to think critically about what other people are writing and then also concise writing of my own.
That's incredible. Just as we kind of wrap up, we were talking beforehand and I understand you're about to launch your own podcast, also called Seed to Harvest. I'd love to understand more about that. What do you want to be talking about and to whom?
Sure. So Seed to Harvest is interviewing folks across media, tech, venture, and startups about their journeys. I specifically look for people who have had non-traditional paths. I think those stories are most interesting. So I recorded the first two with Shuo Chen and then Jenny Lefcourt. I'm going to be focusing mainly on women for the first season. And I think that that's really important because there's not a ton of narratives around women in those spaces. And like, not where it's like, how do you think about diversity in this space? It's like, not about that. It's like, how does your perspective unique and what are like the interesting stories that you have experienced or been a part of throughout your journey that have shaped the way that you are? And so it's been really enjoyable. Like the one that I recorded with Shro, we're both passionate gardeners. And so we spent 15 minutes of the episode talking about how, like, how do you think through like pruning and fertilizing within your venture portfolio? And she was talking about like feeding lemurs on Richard Branson's island because she did a co-investment with him. So I'm super excited for it to come out. I've always loved interviewing people, so wanted to get that started. And then it's going to be sponsored by Stripe, which I'm really excited about to partner with them. They are an incredibly, just have like such an incredible brand and venture and have done so much to democratize access to business tools. And so I'm stoked to be partnering with them and building content again. I like to have like sort of a vessel to produce content in. And so I think that's going to be a really powerful part of the next step of my journey.
That is absolutely incredible. I'm so pleased for you that Stripe is sponsoring, I think, the reach and access that they have. And just listening to your like very, very brief, brief description of kind of pruning and venture, I'm like, okay, that's something I need to listen to like immediately. And I think the great thing about audio is you can be anywhere and listening. It's harder to be anywhere and reading. Like I can't read whilst I'm running. Mm-hmm. I have tried, but it's hard. I certainly can't write whilst I'm running. But I mean, it sounds like a really interesting kind of exploration of, I guess, to your point, that non-traditional path. Something that we're trying to do here as well on Nothing Ventured. I think the stories that aren't heard are the more interesting stories. And often they're from people who aren't out there kind of beating their chests and kind of shouting out into the wilderness. So I think I'm all for more people's stories being shared as widely as possible. So look, Paige, it's been absolutely incredible having you on here. I think we've gone like way over what we anticipated, but I'm keeping every second of this in here. Nothing's going to get edited out. Just before we leave, where can our listeners find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? And how do they find you there?
Mostly on Twitter. My handle is Paige Finn with 3 N's. I rarely check LinkedIn. And also at our website, Behind Genius Ventures, if you're a founder listening and interested in chatting with us.
Amazing. Paige, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Absolutely. Wonderful talking to you as well.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?